Save big money on your outdoor project at Menards. We make landscaping simple with our free, easy-to-use design program and step-by-step project guides. Plus, Menards has the largest in-stock selection of concrete landscape block at the best prices. Save big on everything when you shop at Menards. Visit us in-store or on Menards.com to see our full selection of landscape blocks and get your outdoor project started today. Save big money
at Menards. Hi there. If you have found this feed, it's likely because you did a little search for this obscure thing called Grab Bag Collab, and this is what you found. Congratulations. This is the free feed for GBC, where we drop occasional episodes to show the outside world what's available on our Patreon-based subscription network. You see, Grab Bag Collab is an egalitarian network launched by me, journalist Amber Hunt, along with journalist Amanda Rossman and Tony Award-winning actor Daisy Egan. We release a bunch of exclusive shows via Patreon. That's at patreon.com/grabbagcollab. And those include passion projects that likely wouldn't get picked up by a major podcast network because it's really hard to sell a podcast idea nowadays unless you're already a bona fide celebrity. Today we're dropping into this feed one of our regular shows. We call them backbone shows because they're the content subscribers can rely upon, while other shows are limited run projects that come and go. This is an episode of The Catalyst, a true crime podcast that looks at the backstories of some of history's most horrific criminals with the hope of understanding the most elusive question of all: what made them the way that they are? People interested in true crime are always baffled by the why. Why would someone do these things? What path in life could possibly have led them to commit such atrocious acts? In this podcast, we aim to explore the upbringings and backgrounds of some of history's worst criminals, but with a twist. Because we want you to set aside what you already know about them, we won't use their names until the end of the show, so you can listen anew and hopefully get insight into the question that haunts us the most: why did they do it? Join us as we explore The Catalyst. It's dark, cold, and you have no idea if the Gestapo are behind you. You and your family have been running for days, desperately trying to find somewhere you can live in peace. No longer welcome in your own country, you've been forced to flee west across Europe, across the Alps, toward anywhere not occupied by the Third Reich. No, this isn't the plot of a Sound of Music sequel fan fiction. Instead, it's the story of the fraudster, a French doctor during the Second World War. The fraudster used the fog of war and the chaos of occupied Paris to commit his crimes against people who were simply trying to survive. Born southwest of Paris at the beginning of 1897, the fraudster exhibited all of the red flags of potential serial killers from an early age. Before the age of 10, he was torturing small animals, showing nude photos to other students at his school, and propositioning another boy for sex. According to Death in the City of Light by David King, the fraudster devoured books about famous killers like Dr. Crippen and Jack the Ripper. Somehow no one thought it prudent to remove him from school, so at 11, he brought his father's gun to school and fired it in history class. And as if anyone needed more evidence, he was disturbed. Another time, he claimed to be staging a circus when he stood a friend against a door to throw knives at him. The only people who were concerned, or at least concerned in any kind of documented way, were the fraudster's parents. When the boy was between ages 10 and 12, his mother and father repeatedly took him to doctors for seizures, sleepwalking, and bedwetting. To make matters worse, the fraudster's mother died in 1912, and his father took a new job 15 miles away. The boy, along with his brother, were sent to live with an aunt. Unsurprisingly, he was soon expelled from school there. It would happen again when he rejoined his father, with the new school citing unruly behavior and, quote-unquote, overexcitation. His criminal behavior continued to escalate as he approached adulthood. At 17, he broke into a mailbox and was charged with damaging public property and mail theft. During trial, a psychological evaluation was finally ordered on this child. On March 26, 1914, the fraudster was diagnosed as an, quote, abnormal youth suffering from personal and hereditary problems which limit to a large degree his responsibility for his acts, end quote. Because of this diagnosis, the judge dismissed the charges, saying that the boy appeared to be mentally ill. The fraudster was expelled from two additional schools before finally graduating from a supposedly special academy in July 1915. Historian David King revealed that this special academy was actually private tutoring by his uncle, a math teacher. The fraudster had the unfortunate luck to graduate in the first year of the Great War, known better today as World War I. France was embroiled in a war the likes of which Europeans had never seen, and 6 months later, the fraudster was drafted into the infantry. Deployed in November, he fought near the Belgian border until he was wounded. According to King, another person who fought on the same battlefield as the fraudster estimated that the French there lost 100 men a minute. The victim of a gas attack, the fraudster was also struck by grenade fragments, tearing an almost 3-inch gash into his left foot. Evacuated from the front, his injuries healed, but doctors noticed his severe symptoms of mental illness. World War I was the first large-scale war where psychology and psychiatry were considered, at least a little bit, when treating soldiers from the front.
Save big on everything for your next project when you shop at Menards. We carry the largest in-stock selection of Hunter ceiling fans. They provide consistent comfort all year round and also help reduce energy costs. Right now, save big on Hunter ceiling fans when you shop at Menards. View our entire selection of Hunter ceiling fans today on Menards.com. Plus, our weekly flyer with plenty more great deals happening now. Save big money at Menards.
You just realized your business needed to hire someone yesterday. How can you find amazing candidates fast? Easy. Just use Indeed. Stop struggling to get your job post seen on other job sites. With Indeed sponsored jobs, your post jumps to the top of the page for your relevant candidates, so you can reach the people you want faster. According to Indeed data, sponsored jobs posted directly on Indeed have 45% more applications than non-sponsored jobs. Don't wait any longer. Speed up your hiring right now with Indeed. And listeners of this show will get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/kidsandfamily. Just go to Indeed.com/kidsandfamily right now and support our show by saying you heard about Indeed on this podcast. Terms and conditions apply. Hiring? Indeed is all you need.
The fraudster was sent to a series of facilities, but was soon charged with stealing army blankets, leading to a stint in one jail before again being sent to a mental health facility. His list of diagnoses was growing longer and longer each year. It now included mental depression, melancholia, obsessions, and phobias. This was enough to again rule him not guilty by reason of insanity or mental defect. But it wasn't enough to keep him from the front. Mental illnesses, like shell shock, aka PTSD, would not be treated with any kind of seriousness during World War I. Soldiers who suffered through the severe trauma of the trenches and recovered in the quiet of the French or English countryside, a la Downton Abbey, were often sent back to that front, only to have a panic attack or break down when returning to the scene of their trauma. According to a Guardian article, 306 British soldiers and more than 600 French soldiers were executed by firing squad for cowardice when they ran from the trench. Those governments now admit that many of those executed were suffering from mental illnesses. Anyway, the fraudster was sent back to the front in June 1918. Like many of his comrades, he was quickly overwhelmed at being back in the trenches and suffered a nervous breakdown. Figuring it was the only way out, he shot himself in the foot. While being transferred away from the trenches, he had seizures at the railroad depot in Dijon and remained unconscious for most of the day. This latest incident caused him to be put on leave for 3 weeks to recover. But it was still World War I, and every soldier was needed. After all of the behavior the fraudster had displayed in his 2 years, the French army still put him into a new regiment in September 1918. A ceasefire went into effect on November 11, 1918, sending representatives to Paris for treaty negotiations. Soldiers remained enlisted until the treaty terms were finalized, so the fraudster continued to flit around the French military system. In March 1919, another psych eval was done, this time after complaints of headaches and erratic behavior. The laundry list of diagnoses now included amnesia, sleepwalking, depression, and suicidal tendencies. Finally, enough to get him discharged from the army, the fraudster was first given a 40% disability pension, but when it was reviewed a few months later, it was reassessed to 100%. That same report recommended that the fraudster be committed to an asylum. The author of that report got their wish, but definitely not the way they imagined. The fraudster took advantage of post-war programs offering accelerated education for veterans. And what kind of accelerated education did he complete in only 8 months? A medical degree. Exactly the job you want someone to train for less than a year. After a 2-year internship, he was granted his medical degree in December 1921. This severely mentally ill man, at only 25 years old, was now a fully licensed doctor, free to treat whomever he wished. Prepared to launch a new life, the fraudster moved to a small village east of Dijon and set up practice. The cathedral was commissioned in 1163, but that wasn't the only thing in the village that was old. The only other doctors in town were two elderly ones, and the fraudster set himself apart from them. His advertisements heralded a new, young doctor with the knowledge and energy to keep up with the latest methods, especially compared to those two geezers in town. As his practice grew, the fraudster would secretly sign patients up for the state medical assistance program, allowing him to bill both the patient and the French government. Getting paid twice for the same visit was only one of his schemes. He also favored prescribing highly addictive narcotics, even to children, as a way of creating repeat customers. A pharmacist once complained about a dose that was so high it may have killed the child it was prescribed for. The fraudster reportedly said, quote, "Isn't it better to do away with this kid who's not doing anything in the world but pestering its mother?" End quote. In 1922, his disability payments needed recertifying, which required another psych eval. He refused, calling the exams a disagreeable bit of exhibitionism. The payments continued to come at 100% disability until July 1923. The fraudster then consented to an exam, and it was found that he likely had been having seizures because scars were found on his tongue, probably from biting down. Still, 100% disability seemed a little generous. The fraudster decided not to put up a fight and agreed to have his checks cut to 50%. 5 years after moving to the village, he began an affair with Louise Delavaux, the daughter of an elderly patient. During the few months they had together, I guess they dated. There was a robbery and a fire at the patient's home. And then, within a few months, Louise disappeared. If friends asked the fraudster, he would explain that they had had a fight so bad that she stormed out of town without saying where she was going. When police interviewed neighbors in May 1926, they remembered seeing the fraudster carrying a large trunk out of his car, which just so happened to be like a trunk that had been fished out of the river several weeks later. Inside of that trunk were the remains of a young woman who had been dismembered. The advanced state of decomposition meant that no identification could be made. Police, obviously, ignored this coincidence. Louise was dismissed as a runaway when, in fact, she may have been the fraudster's first victim. Not long after Louise disappeared, the fraudster decided to... Go ahead, can you guess? I bet you didn't. He decided to run for mayor. Because it was a bitter campaign, he decided to play dirty by the summer of 1926. That's 2 months after Louise's disappearance, by the way. And he hired someone to disrupt a debate. After he finished speaking, the person he had hired cut the power to the venue, which in turn blacked out the entire village and started fires. And the result of this property damage and chaos? Well, The fraudster won in a landslide. He won even though it was known around town that he was a kleptomaniac. The stealing didn't stop when he took office either. According to Crime Library, he stole money from the treasury, a drum from a local band, and a large stone cross that he thought was ugly. Suspicious behavior continued to occur around the fraudster. He attempted to, at least outwardly, lead a normal life. He got married in the summer of 1927 to the 23-year-old daughter of a wealthy landowner who gave birth to their son the next year. But domesticity certainly didn't dampen his impulses. In the spring of 1930, a fire broke out at the home of Armand de Bavet, an activist who, according to David King, owned a dairy co-op outside of the village. After the fire was extinguished, responders found the remains of de Bavet's wife, Henriette, dead from an assault with a blunt instrument, a hammer, based on the wound patterns. Authorities also found a substantial amount of money missing from the house, causing them to believe that Henriette may have interrupted a robbery in progress, at least until rumors swirled around town that she was the fraudster's mistress, and witnesses came forward claiming to have seen him near the home on the night in question. One witness in particular, Monsieur Fiscot, made it clear he was going to testify, but first he needed to stop by to see his doctor. And guess who that was? Fiscot's doctor was the fraudster. According to King, the fraudster told his old friend that there was a new treatment from Paris that would relieve his symptoms, and he was willing to give it to Fiscot for free, you know, between friends. 3 hours after leaving his doctor's office, Fiscot died, with the fraudster signing the death certificate, citing an aneurysm as the cause of death. The star witness dead, the investigation floundered. The fraudster wouldn't be removed as mayor until 1933, after being convicted for stealing electricity from the village. By this point, he had set his sights on a larger target. We're talking Paris. 1933 was a bad year for Europe. Hitler took power in Germany, and the fraudster moved to Paris to establish his practice that would serve as a front for his murders. I mean, a lot of other stuff happened, but these two are the most germane to our story. Anyway, since it was the 1930s, the fraudster could inflate his credentials without too much worry of being found out. He began to add treatments to his ads, some real, some not. In a play on language, he described himself as an interne at a mental hospital, which people took to mean intern, except he had been an interne at the hospital, a patient. By simply changing the spelling, he was able to spin the truth to his benefit. On the brass plaque outside of his home office, the fraudster began to add false endorsements. After he had faked a few without getting caught, he added so many that passersby could barely tell it was brass, leading another doctor to file a complaint with their professional association, and the fraudster was forced to remove the plaque. His Parisian practice allegedly had two sides to it, the practice that had as many as 2,000 patients and grew to have an excellent reputation within the city, and the other side, the alleged illegal business where he provided abortions and illicit drugs to addicts under the lies of a curative program. His first patient to mysteriously die was Raymond Hans, who needed help with an abscess in her mouth. The fraudster drove her home while she was still unconscious, and before the day was over, the 30-year-old woman was dead. Her mother demanded an autopsy, which showed elevated levels of morphine in her daughter's body. An investigation was ordered, but never carried out. Even in hindsight, when the fraudster's wartime crimes were discovered, Raymond was not considered a part of his crimes. Over the next few years, the fraudster engaged in various crimes that were mostly nonviolent. There were numerous narcotics violations reported on his practice, but investigations failed to turn up enough evidence for prosecution. When called to a wealthy person's home in 1942 to pronounce the resident dead, he allegedly stole 74,000 francs, but again, somehow there wasn't enough proof. In April 1936, he was caught shoplifting a book and then assaulted the police officer who accosted him. Escaping on foot, the fraudster turned himself in, citing his medical records from the military as proof that he was not responsible for his behavior. It once again worked. He was acquitted on the grounds of insanity and was quietly admitted to a mental health facility. Intimately knowing the system, he was able to gain his release only 7 months later, in February 1937.
You have 5 new messages.
Hey, Carl, it's Jen from Finance. Could you submit your expenses this week?
Hey, Carl, happy Friday. It's Jen, Finance. Just need those receipts today.
Me again, Carl. Really need those receipts, like last week.
Please just tell me where they are. Are you by your desk right now?
Finance teams, you shouldn't be chasing down Carl or anyone else. With Ramp, expenses are sent with a text and reminders happen automatically. Switch your business to ramp.com today and love finance again.
The next 2.5 years were relatively quiet, with tax fraud being his only crimes. But everything changed, for everyone, in September 1939. German troops marched into Poland, catapulting Europe into a second world war only 20 years after the first. As the invasion continued east, German troops also marched west, invading Denmark, Norway, Holland, Belgium, and then finally France. The number of people wanting or needing to flee France increased exponentially. Artists who enjoyed the glowing 1920s in Paris, think James Joyce, Gertrude Stein, Henri Matisse, and more, fled, many to America. For those who couldn't afford steamships or air tickets, they'd resort to anything with wheels. Roads were clogged with hundreds of thousands of cars, many abandoned as they ran out of gas. On June 22, 1940, 40,000 French troops surrendered to the Nazis and occupied Paris. Being occupied by the Nazis allowed for a network of illicit and black market dealings, and the fraudster wanted his share. To make that work, he needed to gain the trust of as many sides as possible. He told members of the French Resistance that he was a spy, helping to identify collaborators. He also regaled them with tales of the war, except they were all stories that had never happened to him, even claiming to have invented secret weapons that killed Nazis without a trace. The fraudster reveled in spinning tales of setting booby traps around Paris to kill the occupiers. But none of it was true. After the fall of Paris, the fraudster's primary operation was the selling of supposed escape routes to fugitives and refugees. While many of his customers, aka victims, would be Jews fleeing the gas chambers, he didn't discriminate. As long as they could pay his fee of 25,000 francs, which was about $500 in 1942 U.S. money, and about $9,500 today. That price tag theoretically paid for keeping one hidden until it was time to depart, any necessary travel papers, and safe passage to South America. The fraudster's new house at 21 Rue Lesueur, purchased in 1941, impressed his victims as a base of operations. He called his network the Fly Tox after a popular insecticide. An inside joke to himself is he called his informants his flies. Among his first documented victims were fugitives, 2 Parisian pimps who had committed armed robbery while dressed in Gestapo uniforms. This, of course, had made them targets of both French and German authorities, and in September 1942, they contacted the fraudster for help. According to Crime Library, they arranged travel for themselves, another pimp, and 2 sex workers. All vanished into 21 Rue Lesueur, and the fraudster was later heard boasting of, quote, killing 3 pimps and their women, branding all 6 as Nazi collaborators, touting their executions as his patriotic duty, end quote. From here, the number of victims increased rapidly. Like previous Catalyst subject, Dr. Harold Shipman, the fraudster had hit upon a system that worked. Nellie Denise Houghton was a pregnant newlywed who came to him for an abortion and was never seen again. Dr. Paul Leon Bronberger, an elderly Jewish man who wanted to escape with his wife, disappeared without a trace. A month after that doctor disappeared, the Nellers, another Jewish family, vanished after having a planning session with the fraudster. Same with the Wolf family and their 6 friends. 1942 saw the Allied invasion of North Africa, aka Operation Torch, and it also saw dismembered bodies being fished out of the River Seine. Among the remains were 9 heads, 4 thighs, and, quote, sundry other mutilated pieces, end quote. French authorities struggled to identify the victims with decomposed pieces to work with, and the Gestapo didn't care much. They were far more worried about the possibility of a network that aimed to help people escape to freedom. The Germans, having been tipped off about this Flytox network that was helping people escape, decided by May 1943 it had to be stopped. They were ready, so they set a trap. See, the biggest problem, besides the rampant killing and dismembering, was that the fraudster blatantly advertised his services. Whether it was greed or his desire for more victims, or a combination of both, he exposed his own network. In early 1943, an informant for the Gestapo named Charles Beretta infiltrated his organization, feeding any important info back to the Nazis. By May, they were ready to make arrests, targeting three men who worked within the fraudster's network. After hours of torture, those men gave up their leader. The fraudster joined them in prison as the Gestapo searched his properties. Well, all of his properties except 21 Rue Lassure. Somehow, that address wasn't listed or was left off a list, so he and his compatriots were questioned and tortured for 8 months, but only about their network smuggling Jews and French resistance out of the country. After 8 months with no confession or new information, they had no choice but to release the fraudster and the three others. And in an ironic twist, those 8 months gave the fraudster more legitimacy as a true member of the resistance. He had now paid his dues. By March 1944, he would have to cash in those favors. Authorities had uncovered their error and found 21 Rue Lassure, and the fraudster was on the run yet again. And how did they discover the house? Well, neighbors complained when thick black smoke began to flood into their homes. The smoke had begun 5 days before, and now it was getting warmer and neighbors couldn't even open the windows. The smell was described by various people as burnt caramel, burnt rubber, or a burnt roast of poor quality. There was a note on the door that read the occupant, the fraudster, would be away for a month. Needing to do something, the neighbors called the police. When the police arrived, they also couldn't get into the house, and the smoke was a growing concern, so they called the fire department. Finally, they got into the house and found the source of the smoke. A coal stove in the basement. Fireman Roger Barodi opened the iron door to find a human hand. As the men looked around the room, they recognized more and more body parts and bones. According to David King, what they thought was a pile of debris was actually a skull, a rib cage, and other recognizable bones. Plus, there was a torso and two skulls on the floor. Just before 10 p.m., the chief of the criminal division was called to the scene. When he arrived, he simply walked through the horror, taking it all in. He and other officers walked into the courtyard and found a smaller building that had what looked to be a doctor's study, and then a bare room with walls of cement that had no windows or furniture. As he was examining the room, the chief discovered a viewing lens that had been fitted into the wall at about 6 feet high. It did not take an experienced lawman to know that this was where victims likely met their end. Exiting this torture room, the police officers moved to the old carriage house that seemed to be a storage space. On the ground, they found a pile of rusty scrap iron, and when they removed it, they found a pit. As soon as they engaged the pulley to lift the iron lid, a horrible stench hit them. Shockingly, the chief climbed down into the pit and stepped into what he realized was a, quote, revolting mix of quicklime and decomposing bodies of varying stages, end quote. Patients and those within the resistance still loyal to the fraudster offered their homes and safe houses to him. If asked, he would always spin a tale of the Gestapo wanting to execute him for killing Germans and collaborators. Trying various disguises, the fraudster settled on a beard and changed his name to Henri Valery. Once Paris was liberated by the Allies in September 1944, he joined the new French forces of the interior, a version of the territorial army or National Guard, and earned a commission as a captain. In an excellent example of a white man failing upwards, the fraudster was put in charge of counter-espionage and interrogation of prisoners, but he couldn't let go of his old ways. When two soldiers under his command were seen robbing and then killing the elderly mayor of a small town, he arrested not the soldiers, but the witnesses. The investigation was quashed, and the thieving soldiers ran off with their booty. Coincidentally, an article was written 3 days later that condemned the fraudster, calling him a soldier of the Reich. Outraged, the fraudster wrote to his old attorney, the one who had defended him years earlier in his many drug cases, and said he needed to fight these filthy Kraut lies. This letter convinced authorities that the fraudster was still in Paris and a dragnet was issued, with none other than Captain Valery as part of the hunt. That this monster's final moments of freedom came the morning of Halloween seems kind of fitting. While at a metro station, he was recognized, not as Valery, but as the fraudster, and he was promptly arrested. Among his belongings were a gun and 50 documents for 6 different identities. A New York Times article from July 1944 reported that he was arrested in a German SS uniform, having sworn allegiance to Hitler. While that hasn't been proven, it wouldn't be a stretch, as self-preservation was a major driving force for the fraudster. When the authorities presented him with the evidence found at 21 Rue Lassure, the fraudster didn't seem particularly concerned. Yes, he had killed 4 people, but those people were enemies of France, collaborators. He had been duty-bound to kill them as a patriotic Frenchman, a member of the resistance. He claimed that there had been no bodies at the Horror House until he began his 8 months prison stay. After his release, he came home to find the corpses and assumed the bodies were collaborators that had been dumped there by members of the resistance. In a Baltimore Sun article, the fraudster was actually quoted as calling the corpses in his house a practical joke. While in a preliminary court hearing, he said, quote, "Undoubtedly, my friends wanted to play a joke on me upon my return," end quote. Authorities housed him on death row while trying to corroborate his claims. If he had been such a crucial member of the resistance, surely others would know him. But they only knew him as a small-time side player. There were no records nor anyone who would testify to any of his tall tales, causing prosecutors to dismiss his entire story. The fraudster was charged with murdering 27 victims for plunder, estimating 200 million francs in cash, gold, and jewels that was never recovered. That's worth about an estimated $4 million today. The trial began on March 18, 1946, delayed by the end of the war and creation of post-war France. Defended once again by Florio, the former attorney in the drug cases, the fraudster stood in front of a 3-judge panel and a jury of 7 men. Families of suspected victims hired 12 civil lawyers to assist prosecutors. His defense was entirely based upon his victims being either Nazis or collaborators, or they had escaped and, in his words, quote, "South America is a big place," end quote. He couldn't possibly disclose the secret weapons he created in open court because it would harm France. According to the Baltimore Sun, the fraudster spoke for 4.5 hours, weaving a, quote, "story of intrigue, plots, and counterplots that extended into 3 continents and many nations, including the United States," end quote. Florio's closing statement continued this theme, painting the fraudster as a hero of the resistance in such a stirring manner that those in the gallery gave him a standing ovation. But the argument didn't have the same impact on those who held the fraudster's life in their hands. After deliberating for only 3 hours, he was convicted on 126 criminal counts, including 26 premeditated murders. Given the grave nature of the crimes, the death sentence was a foregone conclusion. Appeals were immediately filed, citing 2 specific issues. The first held the most promise. Jurors and the judge had reportedly discussed the case with each other. Just days into the trial, reporters overheard one of the 3 judges and 2 jurors chatting and heard them call the fraudster a demon and an appalling murderer. He had tried for a mistrial at the time, but was denied, with the 2 offending jurors just being replaced. In his appeal, he stated once again that a mistrial should have been granted due to the behavior. The second issue he challenged was that some of the victims' families had perjured themselves. They had clearly lied about their loved ones being dead. Obviously, their family members were in South America. All appeals were rejected and the death penalty was confirmed. As the date grew close, guards reported that the prisoner seemed calm while refusing to see a priest, saying he'd prefer to take his baggage with him. On the scheduled day of execution, the guillotine malfunctioned. On May 25, 1946, a portable guillotine, because sure, that was a thing, arrived at the prison to do the job. Apparently, when it's a portable guillotine, it needs to be assembled. At mid-century, condemned prisoners in France were offered a glass of rum and a cigarette. The fraudster turned down the rum, but accepted the cigarette. As he smoked it, he met with the prison chaplain for his wife's sake, telling him, quote, "I'm not a religious man, and my conscience is clean," end quote. Before his hands were tied, he signed a register of the damned. His neck was shaved and the collar was cut from his shirt, both to make it easier to line up the guillotine blade. According to the New York Times, public executions had been banned in France for several years, but a few were permitted to watch this particular execution. One witness, Dr. Albert Paul, said the fraudster, quote, "moved with ease toward the guillotine as though he was walking into his office for a routine appointment," end quote. At 5:05 a.m., the guillotine blade dropped and the head of Dr. Marcel-André-Henri Petiot, a.k.a. the Bluebeard of Paris, dropped into the wicker basket, a smile on his face. A truck picked up his body and took it to the cemetery while an official note was posted on the prison gate. While Petiot was convicted of 26 murders, it's estimated that his total count was closer to 60, with some putting the number as high as 200. The quicklime pit and the coal furnaces made it impossible to determine the exact number of victims. Not only that, but it also made it impossible to figure out the method of death. Many assume Petiot used injections that would have been easy for him to obtain as a doctor. In a city and a country ravaged and traumatized by invasion and occupation, Parisians were forced to endure the terror of a serial killer who took advantage of the chaos to indulge his sinister impulses. With his known number of victims in the dozens, his name should be whispered in warning along with others covered in this series, but he, and more importantly his victims, are largely forgotten in the immense history of the Second World War. To research this story, writer and historian Jen Erdman relied on contemporary newspaper articles, including a few from the New York Times and the Baltimore Sun, information available at crimelibrary.org, and David King's Death in the City of Light, The Serial Killer of Nazi-Occupied Paris. The Catalyst is a production of Grab Bag Collab, created and engineered by Amanda Rossman and narrated and edited by Amber Hunt. You can support us and our other programs at patreon.com/grabbagcollab. That's GRABBAGCOLLAB. Special thanks to Daisy Egan for being our first pass editor and a collaborator on Grab Bag. Music comes from Soundstripe Inc., my dad, Bruce Hunt, and my son, Hunt Van Benskoden.